Does it work?
Okay. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the presidential address of the 2023 annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion. My name is Jin Park. I am president-elect of the AAR and have the privilege of presiding tonight's presidential address. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, allow me to invite Reverend Ann Hamker from the Mayor's Office in San Antonio to give a few welcoming words for AAR. Reverend Ann Hamker is an ordained minister of Evangelical Lutheran Church of America and serves as the first faith liaison for the city of San Antonio for almost 7 years. She is a co-founder of the all-volunteer Interfaith San Antonio Peace Center and recently became the 2023 San Antonio Peace Laureate. Reverend?
Good evening. It is so lovely to be with you tonight. I come on behalf of Mayor Ron Nuremberg. He was not able to make tonight, so I come on his behalf to say welcome to San Antonio. We love our city, and I'll repeat that. We love our city, and it is amazing how we love our city, so much so that we have officially become a compassionate city among 600 other compassionate cities globally. That work means, for me, so now I'm going to describe my day job, but it's to intentionally form collaborations between the faith community, government entities, nonprofits, community groups, businesses, schools, basically anyone who wants to work together to meet the most vulnerable of needs in our city. Currently, we have about 24 community collaboratives formed, from immigration and refugees, to violence prevention, domestic violence, to housing and hunger, food insecurity. It's a long list, but we are energized by it. The work of compassion, interesting, we could go into a whole thing about compassion, but the biggest difference between empathy and compassion, they need each other, they work together, is that empathy takes energy, moves energy between us. But when you're in the agency and action of compassion, you gain energy. You gain energy, and it heals. Our mayor is independent, and his whole platform is compassion. He is in his fourth and final term. He can't run again, but he works compassion from the workforce to businesses, how we develop accessible, affordable, and available housing, to how we have welcomed over 500,000 people migrating and taking refuge in our city. I know some of you were concerned, there was some concern, about coming to this state. You know, every day we wake up to risk, whether we think about it or not. It's risky to have a baby, still, in this day and age. But we're giving birth to a world together. And so coming here, I don't know if it's a risk. I don't look at it that way because I'm in love with my city. But it's a higher risk if we don't do the work. Much more is at risk. And so I welcome you here. We're in a unique place. And people will tell you, we're the seventh largest city in the country, but we still feel like a small town. And we have no idea how we do that. It's just who we are. but we believe it's because we love each other and we work together. The interesting thing, too, I think about cities in Texas is that we're all very different because we're also a very big state. So culturally, there is a difference. And we're the closest inland port to Mexico. And so our population, our demographics, is a large part of who we are and the culture that we're in and the mix that we're about. We have a very long history of interfaith and multi-faith work. And we have something like 43 different cultures here, and it makes us who we are. So I want to leave you in this welcome with a blessing. May you be blessed while you are here to meet a Texan that fills you with love and compassion. May you be blessed to find out from that Texan where the best food is in the city. May you be blessed with the beautiful art and architecture and the river, the beauty of this place. We've stirred up some very beautiful weather for you, so may you enjoy that. May you learn from each other and grow in wisdom and in relations. Thank you for coming to San Antonio. We're glad you're here.
Did you enjoy the music? Yes. Now is the time for me to introduce tonight's speaker. Professor Amir Hussain often says that he thinks in music and he starts his class with music. I was wondering while I was preparing this introduction whether he would do the same tonight in his presidential address and see what happened. We had a live music, we had a music video, so that was great. Starting a non-music class with a music has a special meaning. It transforms the space into something more collaborative, more creative, that can go beyond expectations. This tells us about the nature of Professor Hussain's scholarship and his position in the field of religious studies. He is transforming the field. Professor Hussain earned his PhD at the University of Toronto and is now Professor of Theological Studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He is only the third scholar of Islam to be elected president of the AAR in its history of more than a century. And he is the first Muslim to hold that position. He is transforming the field. He often identifies himself as a, quoting, Canadian Muslim scholar of Islam teaching at a Catholic university rooted in Jesuit and Marymount traditions, end quote. A lot of different traditions together. He is transforming these traditions. Professor Hussain has a long history of service to the AAR. Before he was elected president, he served on the board of the AAR as an elected at-large member. And before that, from 2011 to 2015, he served as editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. In his inaugural editor's note, he said that one of his visions for the Journal of American Academy of Religion was, I'm quoting, to nurture the conversations between theologians and scholars of religion, end quote. I believe a lot of the thing is going on in this year's panels, and I believe that he will touch upon this in his presidential address. He is considered one of the most important scholars and teachers of Islam in America. In his monograph, Muslims and the Making of America, published in 2016, he said, I'm quoting, there has never been an America without Muslims, end quote. After September 11th, misconceptions of Islam became elevated, and two of the most popular, he says, were taking Islam as a violent religion and as a new religion in America. Professor Hussain challenges both misconceptions in this book, and he chronicles the stories of American Muslims, tracing them back to the time of Christopher Columbus in the 15th century. He is also a great teacher. He is the recipient of numerous awards, and in 2008 and 2009, Loyola Marymount University students voted him the Professor of the Year. So tonight, I believe he will enlighten us about the study of Islam, and more broadly, in his own words, I'm quoting, what is the work of our hands when we do the study of religion, end quote. Please join me in welcoming the President of American Academy of Religion, Professor Amir Hussain.
Good evening. A profound thank you to all of you for being here. You'll note that there are closed captions. We tried to work at it. I think it's about 80-85% accurate. If you need the text, those of you that have cellular devices, I think it's been uploaded into the app so you can read it that way. I don't habla very well, neither does the AI, so the Spanish will be completely mangled. So please forgive us for that. We'll see how that goes. I will say something later about the jacket, as it is indeed fabulous. Thank you. The applause for the jacket. But it also needs some explanation. Just let me say for now that it was made for me by Jerry Lee Atwood, the creative force behind Union Western Clothing. But I need to begin with thanks. First of all, thank you to all of you for being here at this address. Thank you for your membership in the American Academy of Religion. Thank you for your being here at this annual meeting in San Antonio, Texas in November 2023. And thank you to Ann Helpke for giving us that welcome from the mayor's office in San Antonio. My master at the University of Toronto was the blessed Wilfred Cantwell Smith, who often noted that the study of religion is the study of persons. And as early as 1950, he wrote that quote that's up there, for basically the student has to deal not with religions, but with religious persons. Likewise, the American Academy of Religion is persons. We, collectively, are the AAR. And let me single out three persons in particular for thanks. I teach at a Jesuit university, which requires me to say that I teach at a Jesuit university. I've observed over almost 20 years that the Jesuits often use 3 points when they talk. My hypothesis is that the number 3 is somehow important to the Jesuits. I may pursue this investigation later. But first, let me thank Professor Jin Park, not because of her kind introduction, for presiding over this address, nor because if all goes well, in a little over 12 hours, she will become the new president of the American Academy of Religion. Instead, let me thank her publicly for her work as the chair of the search committee to find a new executive director for the AAR. That was a huge amount of unexpected and unpaid labor, which began in January of this year, ended almost exactly 5 months later. Thank you, Dr. Park. Second, let me thank Dr. Alice Hunt for her work as our executive director for the past 6 years. I'm sorry that the timing of this meeting and her leaving her position with the AAR meant that we can't thank Alice in person, but thank you, Dr. Hunt, for your work as executive director of the AAR. The third of the three persons to thank is our new executive director, Dr. Claudia Shippert. We don't have a formal welcome for her here, so let me have this as that formal welcome for her here. Thank you, Dr. Shippert, for your work as executive director in day 106. If I can add a fourth person to thank, because I'm not a Jesuit and I can go beyond three, let me thank Nicole Franklin for her service as the acting executive director in the time between Alice Hunt and Claudia Shippert. So publicly, thank you, Nicole, for your work. And finally, let me thank all the AAR staff for their work, not just at this annual meeting, but year-round. Thank you all. So to return to the pressing question on all of your minds, who are you wearing? I'm from Hollywood, to channel the blessed Andy Kaufman. And in Hollywood, we prefer style over substance. So to the jacket. Jerry Lee Atwood, I think, is the successor to Nuta Kolaryenko, a Ukrainian Jewish immigrant who settled in North Hollywood, became known as Nudie Cohn, and through Nudie's rodeo tailors, made the Nudie suit famous in the last century. I think Jerry Lee makes the Nudie suit for this century. And so I asked him to make one for me, but only the jacket, as even I thought a whole suit might be a bit much. It's also the centenary of the birth of Hank Williams, for whom Nudie made one of his most famous suits. That's actually in the Country Music Hall of Fame at a display about nudie suits from last year. So I knew who I had to honor on the back of the jacket. As Jin said, those of you that know me know that I think in music. So I'll say more about old Hank and his work at the end of this address. I also need to apologize, as I wanted to have live music for you during this talk, and not just with the marvelous mariachi, Alma de Jalisco. So thank you to them. They brought us into the ballroom, and they'll help us to exit the ballroom. But I wanted to have other musicians, and that just didn't work out. The first people I approached, because I'm conscious of this particular place in which we're meeting, were Texas legends. Chris Christopherson is 87 years old. He isn't performing much anymore. His manager asked how I got his number and asked that I not call again. Willie Nelson turned 90 this year. His family's reluctant to let him leave Hawaii. Plus his boys, Lucas and Micah, and Micah was actually one of our students at LMU, are on tour with Lucas's band, Promise of the Real, playing as we speak in East Village in New York City. So they couldn't join us tonight. I then thought about where I'm from. Going back to Cali, I was on the phone earlier this year with a California icon, Luis Perez, one of the founding members of our hometown house band, the Este de Los Angeles, Los Lobos. I couldn't afford to bring out the whole band. Yeah, give it up for Louis and David, yeah. But I was sincerely hoping that Louis and another founding member, David Hidalgo, could join us here tonight. But as we talked about the date, and I was so excited because I thought we were actually going to make this happen, Louis realized that it conflicted with their 50th anniversary celebration as a band, which they are doing as we speak tonight at a concert with another California legend, Dave Alvin, at yet a third California treasure, the Fillmore in San Francisco. Reluctantly, I agreed that as important as this presidential address is, it can't touch half a century of Los Lobos. So after the mariachi welcome, we started with a live recording of one of the songs that Louis and David wrote together, Rio de Tenampa. I first heard that song on the Los Super 7 record in 1998, my first full year in Los Angeles. It stayed with me ever since. The chorus leads into the reason the title of this talk is in Spanish. Háblame, Rio de Tenampa, cántame canciones de valor. En este rincón del cielo, deja mi cariño, mi amor. Those of you that habla know from my poor pronunciation that I don't, that I'm not a Spanish speaker, but I've lived now for over a quarter of a century in the Southwest, where Spanish is the dominant language, as it is here in San Antonio, the largest majority Hispanic city in the United States. That's another thing about place, the language spoken there. My Spanish is a survival Spanish that every Angelino has, the, lingua franca, if you will, of our barrio, el pueblo de Nuestra Señora, la Reina de Los Angeles, del Río Porciúncula. As a scholar of religion, I know the importance of language to our work, which, to use the words of the Canadian poet Margaret Avison, carve and emboss characters in our thought. The languages that we often think of as minority are sometimes spoken by the majority of the people. We need to pay attention, not just to persons, but to the languages that those persons speak. I got to know Louis and David through my friend, my hermano mayor, my colleague at LMU, the blessed David Sanchez. I'd pour him out, but they get upset about that. I was his vato loco, as he called me, or sometimes as he called me, his gordo viejo, which I don't think means distinguished gentleman. So it was a treat to be able to turn him on to Los Super 7 and the song that told the story, if you remember the lyrics, about a lady on a hill who gave roses to an Indian boy. That lady is La Virgen, the Virgin of Guadalupe, whose textual reference comes from Revelation 12. Behold, I saw a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon at her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. I met this lady for the first time as an undergraduate in the University of Toronto classroom of the blessed Jerry Bentley, the world's greatest scholar of the visionary English poet and artist, William Blake. It was Professor Bentley who, in discussing a watercolor painting of the Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed with the sun that is now in the Brooklyn Museum, got me interested in the language of the Bible and thereby in theology. As a total aside, I happen to be a Muslim Guadalupano, and I'd encourage my friends who are writing about La Virgen to take seriously those of her admirers who aren't Catholic or aren't even Christian. She is, after all, our lady, and has never asked me to show her my baptismal certificate or any other papers, for that matter. It was this lady that David wrote about in his magisterial first book, From Patmos to the Barrio, talking about the murals of Our Lady in Los Angeles. So in my case, it was the art which sparked an interest in the text, which brought me to the music. There's that triumvirate again. We need to understand more and understand better the music and the art and the text, especially the vernacular music, the vernacular art, the vernacular text, as they all apply to the study of religion. In the last decade, when I edited the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, with David as our book review editor, we brought in art and music and poetry into the journal. As Jin noted, Professor Park noted, I am also a scholar of Islam, and I think the fourth after Wilfred Cantwell Smith, who was president in 1983, Jane McAuliffe, who was president in 2004, and John Esposito, who was president in 2013. So I think I'm the fourth scholar of Islam to be elected to the presidency of the AAR. Not unexpectedly, since the study of Islam only came into the AAR in a formal way in 1973, almost exactly half a century ago to this day, Rich Martin has a beautiful article in JAR about Islamic studies at the AAR, and it was 1973 that the first standalone panel on Islam was held at the annual meeting. So it's the 50th anniversary of the study of Islam here at the AAR. With this small group of scholars, not surprisingly, all three of them, Wilfred, Jane, John, have been mentors, teachers, and friends to me. This address will not be able to reach their heights of eloquence and scholarly importance. I think in particular of Jane's magisterial address in 2004, reading the Quran with fidelity and freedom, that 20 years later is still required reading. We have had extraordinary leadership in the AAR. I literally, in preparation for this moment, reread the last dozen presidential addresses. You know, I knew I wouldn't be able to replicate this scholarly work that we do here in the leadership of the AAR. That's what made me think more generally of the work that we do as scholars of religion, la labor de nuestras manos. I wasn't sure at first what verb to use. I come from the working class, and so trabajo is the first word that came to me. This is me, 1970, those who know Toronto, coming out of Parkdale. I do have a gun, I am holding a gun. There are some stereotypes that are true. My uncle did give me the gun to take care of my mother. I don't know why I have the gun. My mother still hasn't figured that one out. But from working class roots, trabajo is the word that I know. I talked with some of my Spanish-speaking friends, who says that's obra, but that has a sense, I think, of something completed, work that is done and not ongoing. So it was labor for me, the more natural cognate with labor. Yeah. Most of us do our work in our own quiet little corners, sitting at our tables and writing good songs, to use the metaphor that David sang about in Rio de Tinampa. By definition, most of us will not be scholars who change the discipline. Most of us, by definition, will not write the book that changes the field. or even our small corner of it. I'm also a Canadian who became a naturalized U.S. citizen a decade ago. As a Canadian, I come from a land of poets. You know some of them. Aubrey Graham, Lenny Cohen, Peggy Atwood, Michael Andacci, just to name the first four that come to mind. I think our greatest is the incomparable Joni Mitchell, who I think is simply the finest songwriter that my country has ever produced. And we've produced some pretty fine songwriters. I use this line from Case of You in my classes all the time. All the stuff that I've written, I couldn't write those four lines. Those four lines are just genius, you know. But one of my favorite Canadian songwriters, Stan Rogers, dead for over 40 years now, who passed just a few months before I began undergraduate work at the University of Toronto. Canadians of a certain age know Stan, R. Woody Guthrie. He sang the songs of the people, celebrated as Woody did the work of our hands. He wrote a song, McDonald on the Heights, for what would be his last studio album, From Fresh Water, released posthumously in 1984. It tells the true story of Lieutenant Colonel John McDonald, who died in the War of 1812 during the Battle of Queenston Heights. McDonald was one of the officers under the command of the British Major General Sir Isaac Brock, who helped the forces to regroup after Brock was killed on the battlefield. McDonald was shot the same day as Brock, died the following day. As I mentioned earlier, I think in music, and Stan's chorus of his song about McDonald again makes me think about our work. You brought the field all standing, Stan wrote, with your courage and your luck. But unknown to most, you're lying there beside old General Brock. So you know what it is to scale the heights and fall just short of fame and have not one in 10,000 know your name. And have not one in 10,000 know your name. I think that's another way for me to get at the theme of this address, La labor de nuestras manos. What is the work of our hands? Many of us, myself included, teach primarily undergraduate students, don't work with graduate students. We may have taught thousands of students, whether that teaching was in graduate school, or as an adjunct, or a contingent faculty, or tenure track faculty. But outside of our own teaching, we may not have one in 10,000 know our name. As I noted earlier, most of us, by definition, will not write the book that changes the field. And yet we still write works of tremendous value. Yeah. To lift up just one of those tonight, I think of my friend Dr. Tito Madrazo and his marvelous book from a couple of years ago, Predicadores, Hispanic Preaching and Immigrant Identity. It's not a book that made a huge splash when it was published. It wasn't reviewed in the top journals. I was talking with Kimberly Davis just today. It's there on Reading Religion. I hope someone picks this up to review this for Reading Religion, because it's a beautiful, beautiful little book that does some of the best ethnographic work that I've read in years. Tito is a Baptist minister with a doctorate in theology from Duke Divinity School. At Duke, he directed the Hispanic, Latino, preaching initiatives. And the book is a result of 4 years of collaborative ethnographic work with the predicadores and predicadoras that he writes about. There's a line I try to steal from Woody Guthrie every chance I get, the poetry of ordinary lives. And Tito helps us to understand the poetry of the lives of the people who aren't often studied. While Tito has held teaching and research positions, he, like so many of us in the AAR, has always done his work outside of the traditional tenure track line. His book also echoes the moral and ethical imperative that Wilfred Cantwell Smith gave to us all, to be concerned with the persons about whom we write. In 1975, and this is Wilfred's genius, he's writing this in 1975, in an essay called Objectivity and the Failure of the Modern University. Think about that one. He's talking about the failure of the modern university in 1975, based on a presentation a year earlier at a conference at the University of Iowa. In that essay he wrote, and it's a lengthy quote, but I'm gonna quote this here. Let me report another incident from my experience in Asia, this time from Lebanon, and with an anthropologist whom I met. This gentleman, a Westerner, admitted to me quite bluntly that he was in fact not at all interested in his Lebanese villagers as persons, nor indeed in the Middle East as an area. He had come out for years' research from this country, he said, in order to test in that village in Lebanon certain general theories that the discipline of anthropology back home had formulated. He hoped to use his findings to confirm or rebut or more probably refine those theories. And at the end of his year, he would return to his academic appointment in this country, publish his results, and hope because of them to get a promotion or at least a raise in salary. His ambition was by means of his publication to advance his own academic career. Simultaneously to advance the so-called, and he puts this in scare quotes, science of anthropology. And then Wilford adds, as only he does parenthetically, the concept of academic career, by the way, is a recent development and a very sad one. In other words, this intellectual was using persons for his own private purposes or for the purposes of advancing Western science. This, I feel deeply in either case, is immoral, not to say sinful. As we do our work, I would ask us to keep Wilford's comments in mind and to think about the morality and the ethical implications of our work. As I noted with Tito, a third of our membership in the AAR is non-tenure-track faculty. In one of my three presidential plenaries, I wanted to lift up their work and their concerns. That panel will happen here tomorrow at 11 a.m. In both that panel and the other two, I also wanted more generally to lift up the work of our members. I sometimes get tired, or if I'm speaking more accurately, frustrated at times when we don't celebrate our own, when we bring in outside experts, neglecting the expertise that is literally all around us in the membership of the AAR. We have giants among us. If you are paying attention to the presidential plenaries, you'll see that the other two weave in the theological with the study of religion. I don't think that religious studies and theology is an either or, but a both and. This is evident to me as a scholar of Islam, where I think some of the most interesting work in the study of Islam is happening in theological circles. You saw some of that in today's plenary about Muslim chaplains. You'll see it in Monday's plenary about constructive Muslim theology. I am an AAR lifer, and much of the academic work of my hands has been here with the AAR. I've been a member since 1989, and have been to every annual meeting since 1992. I'm 58 years old. That means I've been attending the annual meeting for over half of my life. Not half of my adult life, not half of my professional life, half of the time that I've been on Earth. You know, when I first started with the study of Islam section in 1992, I didn't realize it'd been in existence for less than 20 years. There were a small number of us in those days, to the point where we could organize a dinner at the annual meeting that was attended by most of us. In 2001, after the September terrorist attacks, you'll recall we met in November in Denver. That meeting was so important for so many of us, most of whom worked in places where we were the sole scholar of Islam. It gave us a chance to talk together with each other in those pre-social media days about the things that we were experiencing, especially those of us who also happened to be Muslim. In those days, we had only the 20th century technology of the email to connect virtually with each other. We used that to issue a statement as scholars of Islam that went out on Monday, September 17th, 2001. One of the many great good things about the AAR and the annual meeting specifically is provide opportunities for scholars to meet together to discuss not only our work, but also our lives. A little more than 20 years later, November 20th, 2022, also in Denver. I became the president of the AAR. That same afternoon, we put out a statement from the AAR Board of Directors, the first of four statements we'd put out in my presidential term. That was about the mass shooting that took place just 70 miles away from where we were meeting at Club Q in Colorado Springs. At the beginning of this year, we put out a second statement in response to the concerns of many of our members about meeting here in Texas. And please know, I understand and empathize with our members who will not or cannot travel here. There are places that I will not go. But those that know me know that I'm an optimist. I think that's because at heart I'm a teacher, and I don't know how to teach without being optimistic. I understand that as a member organization with literally thousands of members, we can't satisfy them all. What I did find humorous was the email I got from a white male colleague who lamented that I simply did not understand, and I quote, the issues faced by our marginalized faculty of color. That was a good one for me, because it's like, have you seen me? Do you know anything about my history? Growing up, working class poor in Toronto in 1970, where the racism was openly expressed on bumper stickers, people had no problem putting racist bumper stickers on their car for all to see. I respectfully disagreed with my colleague. The third statement that we put out as a board was the announcement of Dr. Shippert as our executive director. So that one was uncontroversial. The fourth statement was the one last month about the crisis in Israel and Palestine. We are a scholarly organization whose mission, and I quote from our mission statement, is to foster excellence in the academic study of religion and enhance the public understanding of religion. And that statement was put out with that mission in mind. Some of our members expressed their concerns about that statement. Many others wrote to us to support it. Some of our members are scholar activists, some are not. In 2020, AAR President Jose Cabazon put together the AAR Presidential Futures Task Force under the leadership of Catherine McClymont. I was on that task force along with others in this room, and I think in some sense that's what began to get me thinking about the work that we do. In our report, which is available on the AAR webpage, we came up with, and I'm quoting here from the report, two foundational and critical activities members consistently expect the AAR institutional structure and programming to support. Number one, fostering increased connections between individuals, among and between communities of scholars with similar research and pedagogical interests, and between scholars working in a wide range of professional settings, including but not limited to universities. And two, expanding what constitutes scholarship in the Guild. To that second activity, we will be working on developing guidelines about evaluating public scholarship. I'm hoping that will be useful for some of our members. In thinking about the work of our hands, I thought of the work of another of my Los Angeles homeboys, the blessed Lenny Cohen. In 1999, after leaving the Zen monastery on Mount Baldy, where he had been the monk Jikan, silent one, noble silence, I'm not sure how best to translate it, for years, Lenny, or Rabbi Eliezer, as I called him, said in an interview with Larry Sloman, and I'm quoting here from Lenny Cohen, but I really am a writer, and a writer is deeply conflicted. And it's in his work that he reconciles those deep conflicts. And it doesn't set the world in order. It doesn't really change anything. It just is a kind of harbor. I love that image. In the work of our hands, we don't set the world in order. We may not change anything, but we are a kind of harbor. As someone whose family includes sailors, including an uncle who retired as a vice admiral, the image of a harbor is a very powerful one for me. One of those harbors for me, as I noted earlier, is music. And that brings me full circle in conclusion to the jacket, an old Hank. Hiram, Hank Williams, is one of the most important figures in American music in the 20th century. Died on New Year's Day, 1953, at the age of 29, a year younger than Jesus when he began his public ministry. Hank was posthumously inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He wrote 167 songs, recorded 38 written by others. That song catalog forms the basis of American country music in the second half of the 20th century. But I think it also establishes his place as one of the most important American theologians during that time. I don't think we study music as much as we should in the study of religion, and that's not a knock on the work that we do here. I think we need to do more of it. Vernacular music, even more so. It is his work as a musician slash popular theologian, which I think is what is underrated. We know the importance of his body of work, but for an artist of his stature, there's relatively little attention paid to it. He was known as the Hillbilly Shakespeare, but no one has seriously examined his work and its subsequent influence on American popular music. I think that his work is a crucial part of Protestant theology in 20th century America. Both his popular songs like I Saw the Light and the explicitly moral songs that he wrote and performed under the Luke the Drifter persona, like Men with Broken Hearts. Yeah. In that time, before the election of John Kennedy, when Protestants had a firm hold on the soul of America, Hanks was the voice that people heard, as much as they heard Billy Graham or Norman Vincent Peale. In the new year, I'll turn my attention to him, beginning to work on a book about his importance as an American theologian. I think that's exactly what a Canadian Muslim scholar of Islam who teaches at a Catholic university should be doing as the work of his hands. And I want to thank you all, again, for the work of your hands. As the mariachi, Alma de Jalisco, plays us out, and you go to your various receptions and other events, I hope that you are able to celebrate your work and celebrate each other. Thank you. Thank you.